continuing, and we're nearing a conclusion of chapter 36 of Canto 10. There's two things before we go to chapter 36. One of them is there was an outstanding question about a few days ago. You asked, you heard something, Lord Ramachandra appears, certain number of yuga cycles in between. So the research concludes, according to Lagu Bhagavatamrita, part 1, chapter 3, there's chapter 3 is the Leela Avatars. And at the end of that Leela Avatars section, Jiva Goswami writes, the last, some number 8 or something like that, in the list, which includes Lord Ramachandra, appears once in a day of Brahma. And then earlier in that same chapter, the statement is that it's the 24th yuga cycle during the reign of Vaivasvatamanu. So Vaivasvatamanu is Manu number 7. This is the 28th yuga cycle, or four yuga cycles ago, during this same Vaivasvatamanu, during the Dwarpa Yuga at that time, that's when Ramchandra appeared. Interesting. And there was also some question about the bow of Kamsa and what's the story behind the bow of Kamsa. So there's two references. One is the history of the bow. So this is from Gopal Champu, and the section is describing the strength of Kamsa. So just to get an idea of the strength of Kamsa, which has something to do with the bow. Gopal Champu writes that Kamsa subdued Keshi, how he got Keshi as his companion or servant, is he was going on a campaign beating up people and destroying the kingdom and all their people, and then the leader. And so Keshi, punching it again and again, Kamsa subdued Keshi, mounting the horse. Very powerful Kamsa rode to Mount Mahendra. 100 times the demon king Kamsa uprooted the mountain, held it high, and set it again in its place. When he saw Lord Parashuram, who was as effulgent as the sun at the time of cosmic dissolution, whose eyes were now red with anger, Kamsa bowed his head before the sage, circumambulated him, and fell at his feet. Humble, right? Pacified by this, Parashuram, his eyes fierce, said to Kamsa, "Oh, worm! Oh, baby crab! You are insignificant as a mosquito. Today I will kill you, who are a wicked kshatriya, falsely proud of his strength. This great bow by my side weighs 100,000 bharas." And I looked up, I couldn't find how much a bar is. Really heavy. "This bow was given by Lord Vishnu in the battle for Tripura city, to kill the Kshatriyas. I received it from Lord Shiva's own hand. So Vishnu made a bow for Lord Shiva to defeat and become victorious in the Pura city battle. And he gave it to Parashuram directly with his own hand. If you can draw this bow, it will be good for you. If you cannot draw it, I will destroy your strength. Drum roll, music. Hearing these words, the demon picked up the bow made of 7 palm trees. As Parashuram watched, Kamsa easily strung it. 100 times he drew the bowstring back to his ear and released it with a thunderous sound. The sound echoed in the universe of 7 planetary systems and outer space. It made the elephants that support the directions tremble, and it made the stars fall to the earth. Putting the bow back in its place and bowing again and again to Lord Parashuram, Kamsa said, "O Lord, I am not a Kshatriya. I am a demon. And I am your servant. I am the servant of your servant. O Supreme Person, please protect me." Hearing this, Lord Parashuram was pleased with him and gave him that bow. That's how he got the bow. Sri Parashuram said, "Whoever breaks this bow of Lord Vishnu will kill you." Sri Narada said, "Then Kamsa bowed down before the sage Parashuram. As Kamsa thought of all this, he became filled with pride. No king could fight with him. They only brought him gifts." So that's where the bow came from. And then there is the bow sacrifice. This is described in Brahmavivarta Purana. Sri Narayana Rishi said, "O sage, after some thought, the intelligent priest Satyaka, who was a disciple of Shukracharya, gave the following advice to Kamsa. Satyaka said, 'Oh, very fortunate one who give up your fears. Why should you fear while I am present? You should offer a yajna to Lord Shiva, a yajna that will stop all calamities. The yajna called Danur Yajna, or the yajna of the bow, where abundant food and charity are distributed, ends all nightmares and destroys the fears brought by enemies. This yajna brings good fortune and breaks the calamities brought by the demigods, the elements, or one's own self." You know, the 3 kleshas. "When the yajna is completed, Lord Shiva will appear. He will give all good fortune. He will give a boon that removes old age and death. Parashuram, who is an ocean of mercy, kindly gave that bow to you. O king, that very strong bow is 1,000 hands long and 10 hands thick. It was built according to Lord Shiva's wish. When placed in this bow, the Pashupata arrow becomes invincible. Nothing can stop it. Only Lord Narayan can stop it. In this yajna, you should worship both Lord Shiva and his bow. You should invite everyone and perform this sacrifice at once. O king, if in this yajna the bow is broken, then the performer of the yajna will die. Of this there is no doubt. If the bow is broken, then the yajna cannot be completed. If the yajna is incomplete, who will give the yajna's results? The demigod Brahma resides at the root of this bow. Lord Narayana resides in its middle, and Lord Shiva resides at its tip. This bow is bent in three places. It is studded with all kinds of jewels. Its splendor eclipses the summer midday sun. O King, even powerful Lord Shesha Surya and Kartikeya cannot bend this bow. Then what can be said of others? It was with this bow that Lord Shiva happily killed the demon Tripura. Therefore, in a great festival and without any fear, you should perform this auspicious yajna of the bow. Brahmavaivarta Purana. And there's one more, I can read it out, but because there was a question about which of the demons killed by Krishna and Braja, what was their previous life, how were they so fortunate, etc. So I spent a fair amount of time going through two texts, the same two. Brahmavaivarta Purana and Garga Samhita. And it's nearly complete, so I'll send it to somebody. Send it to you, and then you can forward it to whoever or the online people or something like that. Okay. So we're at chapter 36, text number 27, and Kamsa's winding up his plan with Akura to bring Krishna to Mathura and invite him to the bow festival, Danur Yagya, with religious ceremonies and so forth and so on, and to bring bring Nanda with his people. So, text 37 reads, "Now that you understand my intentions, please go at once and bring Krishna and Balaram to watch the bow sacrifice." Here the Sanskrit is Danur Makha instead of Danur Yagya, bow sacrifice, and see the opulence of the Yadu's capital. Because he's of the Yadu dynasty, now that he knows he's the son of Vasudev and Devaki. So these are his relatives, and see the opulence of your relatives, you know, family business. So Vishwanath writes, Kamsa said, quote, "You should not tell the secret plot to others, but you should speak as follows, inviting the boys to the Danur Yagya bow sacrifice." Jiva Goswami, "Fooling them by the attractions, you can bring these two foolish children. The bow sacrifice and the splendor of the city will be attractive to boys coming from the forest." Harivansha says, "You should speak to Nanda as follows, quote, go quickly to Mathura, bringing your yearly tax with the cowherds. Kamsa, his servants and priests desire to see the sons of Vasudev, Krishna and Balaram. I have heard that the two boys are expert at fighting. Fighters who bring death in the arena, determined and most perseverant. Our two wrestlers are prepared for this festival, festive combat. Your two boys, expert at fighting, should compete with them," unquote. "I must see these two boys living in Vraja who wander in the forest, the sons of my father's sister. Who are like devatas. You should tell the people of Vraja that the rejoicing king will perform a sacrifice for the bow. The citizens should stay nearby comfortably, for the invited guests there will be unlimited milk, ghee, yogurt, and buttermilk to be given freely and for cooking. Text 38. Sri Akura said, O King, you have expertly devised a process to free yourself of misfortune. Still, one should be equal in success and failure, since it is certainly destiny that produces the results of one's work. Now, we heard earlier that Kamsa was expert at artha and kama, but not dharma and moksha, shastras. So he's now bringing in, he's honoring his savvy in artha, shastra, but he's bringing in now a higher source of knowledge than he's accustomed to. So here we go. Vishwanath's commentary. Quote, you have thoroughly considered how to avoid your death. But now hear the words of Niti Shastra. In regards to success or failure, one should perform the action with a cool head, since fate alone determines the result. Jiva Goswami writes, after hearing this, with a desire to accomplish seeing the Lord, this is Akura, and as a result to bring about the death of Kamsa, which he long desired, he desired to announce his friendship with Kamsa by praising him. Because he's invited in the inner circle as a friend, so he's responding as a friend. But he's a minister, so he's serving in that capacity. That is expressed in two verses. You have considered correctly because you are the king. It is permitted in the scriptures for the king to use force. Question. Why did Akura, follower of Dharma, permit punishment? Answer. Hearing all of Kamsa's false words, he hid his true intentions and simply repeated Kamsa's view in praise. One should endeavor for solutions to such problems by taking the advice of scriptures. If one ignores this, one becomes sinful. Without joy or sorrow, samaha, one should do this with composure. And Sanatan Goswami's commentary. I am satisfied with this result after acting favorably to this wicked person for so long. Actually, it is done for my benefit. Therefore, I should act for his benefit. Quote, in not saying it is beneficial, he will worry that I am indifferent. If, not trusting me, he does not send me, my long-held desire will not be fulfilled. What's his long-held desire? See Krishna. I will thus speak some encouraging words to him. This he does with two verses. O King, you should protect your body and your kingdom. This act should follow Niti Shastra for kings, not karma scriptures. One should perform actions, whether successful or a failure. One should not rejoice on success, and one should not feel pain on failure. Why? Your fate produces the result. What will effort alone accomplish? And text 39, we'll conclude. He continues speaking to Kamsa. An ordinary person is determined to act on his desires even when fate prevents their fulfillment. I'll read it again. An ordinary person is determined to act on his desires even when fate prevents their fulfillment. Therefore, he encounters both happiness and distress. Yet, even though such is the case, I will execute your order. A little puzzling. Vishwanath purport. This is now the BBT purport. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains that although what Akura said was courteous and encouraging, his hidden meaning was far different. What he really meant was this, quote, your plan is not fit to execute, yet I will carry it out since you are the king and I'm your subject, and in any case, you're about to die. So here's what Vishwanath writes. Quote, living entities, low forms, not you, perform activities with expectations that are sometimes fulfilled and sometimes unfulfilled, leading to happiness and distress, but I will carry out my orders so that you will be happy. This is the external meaning. Another meaning, two more other meanings. Though it is not proper to carry out an order of you who desire to die, I will do so because you are the king and I am a citizen. Or another meaning is, though your desires will not be fulfilled, mine will be fulfilled, so I will carry out your order. That's different ways of rendering the Sanskrit of the verse. And Jiva Goswami writes, quote, a person like me, dedicated to Dharma without attachment, should not do this, but I will follow your order since you are the king, the embodiment of all devatas. He shows devotion to Kamsa in order to hide his true intentions. Quote, being defeated by fate, or even being successful, one endeavors for fulfilling desires and must experience joy and sorrow. He is not like a detached person who is happy. Though this is the case, I will follow your order. And comment is, he indicates the future. Next. You will rid yourself of misfortune since you will be liberated. For Krishna, Daivam, is the giver of all results. You cannot do anything independently. People like you are struggling against fate. If the Lord is the doer, then I am insignificant. Thus, I will do what is favorable for him as a devotee. Paragraph. After the killing of Arishta, Kamsa spoke to the Yadus in an inflamed manner and criticized Vasudeva. They also condemned Kamsa. Kamsa spoke like a blind person. This is the opinion of Harivamsa. And last is Sanatan Goswami, who writes, he illustrates this. On attaining one's desire, one rejoices, and on not attaining one's desire, one laments. Thus nothing is certain, since the force of karma is dominant. Therefore, one should not be attached to the result. Fate overrides human effort. Niti Shastra says this is to be rejected. In his statement, he places lamentation after rejoicing, analyzing the words, harsha shokabhyam. This indicates that Kamsa will not attain his desire and will ultimately lament. Quote, thus, though it is not proper for me to act at this time, Because I'm under your control, I will follow your order. Accordingly, according to your order, I will go to Vraja, not by my choice. He hides his true feelings. So, again, divine demoniac nature. And occurs certainly in a difficult spot. Fortunately for Akura, he understands Krishna is all-powerful. So there's no putting Krishna at risk. He understands that the prophecy of the voice from the sky will be fulfilled. He knows that Krishna is that eighth son of Devaki. And so it's fulfillment of prophecy. And he's just an instrument of Krishna and the fulfillment of prophecy. And he's giving not some insulting advice contrary to Kamsa's plan. He's flattering him, oh, it's a good plan. But he's also indicating gently, it's going to be unsuccessful. And you're going to fulfill your own death. There's other places where it says, he said, surely I'll go, but I'm a minister and I'm obliged to speak. Ministers are obliged not to flatter, but to speak the truth. You're inviting your death. But here I go, because you're the king. And besides that, I want to see Krishna. So he stayed when so many of the Yadus fled, some remained, and he remained not because he was attached to being in a, you know, big city. He knew that Krishna would appear and he wanted to see Krishna. So here's the doors now been opened by Kamsa. Of course, the door has been opened by Krishna. And Kamsa was the instrument, and he was the instrument of Krishna. He's quite Krishna conscious. There's some cloud or some question mark above Akura's behaviors later in Dwarka. And, you know, there's so many mysteries within the mystery of Krishna. But he's an instrument of Krishna. Rupa Goswami teaches us that he attained perfection. And his prayers to Krishna, that's of the nine processes of bhakti, vandanam is one of those nine processes, and the one who achieved perfection through vandanam is Akura. And yet he did, you know, some apparently really bad stuff. Related to the Shambhataka jewel and the Satrajit and all of that, he was involved. So that's another discussion, but he's a very interesting pure devotee case. He's in the service of Kamsa. I mean, Sanatana Goswami, Rupa Goswami, being in the service of Nawab Hussein Shah, they considered themselves fallen, non-Vaishnava. And that's, you know, their mood. And Akura's in the service of Kamsa. Who's worse, Kamsa or Nawab Hussein Shah? They were ministers. He's a minister. So their pastimes are certainly diverse. We can't necessarily match up this one with that one, and who's better, Akura or Rupa and Sanatana Goswami, who's worse. They're acting under the Lord's plan, That's the similarity. And they have their particular mood or regard about their position in the service of another. And in any event, Krishna's plan is being fulfilled. And Akura's getting the good fortune of being part of Krishna's wonderful plan. One more morning and we're finished, but tomorrow is Balaram's appearance day, so we'll speak something about Balaram. So we can complete the chapter most likely on Tuesday, and then we'll move on to the next chapter, Krishna permitting. So let's see if there's some discussion here.
I was trying to understand this text 39.
Which one?
39.
I'm listening.
An ordinary person is determined to act on his desires even when fate prevents their fulfillment. So I was just trying to understand, how do we differentiate, I mean, how do we understand what is the fate? And then if we understand fate, then we probably don't have to act.
Well, most people don't understand fate. Your question is, how do we understand fate?
Right.
It's not like that's the requirement for you to act, that you have to know ahead of time what's the outcome. That's what fate is.
Right.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
We're not required to understand what fate is.
Yes, then if we don't understand the fate, then we have to endeavor for something.
Yeah.
So
we have to endeavor for something because we're living entities.
Yeah. Okay.
We follow Dharma. So he's not following Dharma. I mean, there are some elements of Dharma, but the elements of Dharma for him are just because it's artha kama. It's not what real Dharma is meant for. But he doesn't know that. He's not interested in knowing that. And one who lives that way, you know, on the fate side, they're paving their path downward.
The way I understand this is, ordinary people, they know that they act on something, they know that that's not their fate, but they still act. Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah. But, you know, they're not factoring Dharma and being under the protection of the Supreme Lord, because when you're under the protection of Supreme Lord, whatever is the outcome, you're protected. They're not considering. They're just attached, you know, fruitive, atheistic people, they're just attached to doing something to get something. That's all they know.
Understand is when is the time we say that, okay, this is fate and give up, when is the time when we still endeavor and do it?
Oh. For us, it's simple. So don't make it complicated. Let's just take the instruction, distribute my books. Distribute books. Well, it's not fated that I'm like a very qualified book distributor, so I'll just stay home. Some persons, they're really gifted at distributing books, and I'm the small timer, and so, you know, let the gifted person distribute the books. Because it's not fated for me to be the quality. So, you know, that's not our criterion. What's pleasing to Krishna is our criterion, and how do we know that? Through disciplic succession and scripture and so forth. So our interest is not fulfilling destiny. And then comes her question, you know, the plan making and the his question, the over endeavoring. What's the proper where's the line? Proper endeavor, over endeavor, you know, over planning and, you know, some plan. So, you know, that's a discretion. We covered those topics. But at least the principle, Krishna is to be pleased. And that's the destiny, pleasing Krishna. Supposing, you know, we're not so gifted at something. You're not a good cook. Then don't cook. You cook. And learn how to cook, etc. Fate is not our barometer. He's speaking to a demon. No, your question is, what about us? So we don't use that measure or that great kind of criterion. Okay?
So when we experience distress, many times we might not know it's coming from a desire, or like in this,
we might not know what is coming from a desire.
Like in this verse, it says, you know, when you experience distress or happiness, it's coming from desires that are unfulfilled. And so my question is, like, many times when you are experiencing distress, we kind of tend to accept it as Krishna's plan, and also at least I process it like, oh, you know, this too shall pass. But is there something that we can look deeper into, in the sense, because that's really Krishna's plan, but how do we even understand it, what we're experiencing, and how do we go through it?
The last part, your voice went really soft. But just the last part, please.
Oh, I was saying, how do we understand what is happening?
How do we understand what is happening? Keeping it simple, because I like keeping things simple. We're getting purified. And all those happinesses and distresses, they're within the mind. You know, the Avanti Brahman story, they're within the mind. And the mind is the covering, and it's not what real happiness and what real distress is. So that's like, you know, high level. So once you're, if you're aiming towards high level, then there can be detachment from the temporary. Just yesterday, there was some little video exercise for the social media stuff, from seminars to encourage people to go to the seminars. So there's a social media thing, and it was, you know, the overcoming negative emotions, the art of meditation, was, you know, the seminar series. So there's some different exercises, but One of those exercises is pertinent to your question, that you're the observer and there's the mind, and then there's images in the mind and emotions connected to the images in the mind, and you're the observer. Knowledge and detachment. So that's Bhagavad Gita. But so your question is there a deeper message? Yeah, it's illusion. Now, okay, let me manage the illusion. One of the ways to manage the illusion is the illusion is cast by reality. So go to the reality position, and then you can take, you know, responsible according to Shastra and Guru and Sadhu, you can take appropriate action in the world of illusion. But, you know, in the mood of detachment, it's not like that's going to determine your worth, or it's going to determine getting happy emotions instead of the unhappy ones. You're just buying into the duality program by trying to do that. You're to act responsibly. And, you know, we don't, negative emotions are distracting for sure. So it's detachment. And then another is, you know, what's more important to me than having a happy ride in the realm of illusion is the journey towards reality. And the more you can direct attention towards the journey to reality, those negative emotions subside. That is, darkness is dispelled by light. And progressively, as one's life moves towards the light, those the pressing of negative emotions cools down, and you have clearer intelligence and connection with Krishna, so you know better how to deal with the thing and the emotion connected with the thing. That's irritating. It's part of the spiritual journey. For any discipline, not only ours, any, you know, they have different ways of looking at going about handling pain or, you know, going for salvation. So for us, it may start with Sankhya, but the mature fruit of Sankhya is to connect with Paramatma, and to connect with Paramatma, the mature fruit is to connect with Bhagavan and be in devotional service. So, you know, at different levels we can be functioning, but the ultimate level is where we're going. And don't lose sight of where we're going. And then you go back to the, you know, to whatever level or tool may be, and you align them with the goal. I mean, so then you can take a particular, okay, that's a nice model. How does it work with such and such and such and such? And so you can analyze the application of our spiritual technology, and then you experiment and you practice and you become purified and you become better at it, you know, because higher consciousness results in diminishing of darkness. You can handle the situations better because of higher consciousness, and they become less pressing and urgent.
So we have a few online questions.
Okay.
And the first one is from Amara Mataji, and she asks, Kamsa had so much strength and benedictions and opulence. What keeps one away from realizing the mercy of the Supreme Lord and being deeply grateful that they can put their hearts in service to the Supreme Lord? Is mercy not obvious to be recognized for them?
Well, yeah, there's the demoniac mentality is described in chapter in Bhagavad Gita, and persons who have demoniac mentality, they're not interested in mercy. I'm perfect, powerful, and happy, and I've conquered my enemies, and I'm going to conquer some more. And, you know, they're puffed up. They're not looking for any mercy. You know, his show of submission to Parashuram was totally calculating, totally manipulative, disingenuous. It's not like Parashuram didn't know it, but, you know, he reciprocating. Because he's, anyway, the answer to her question is, demoniac mentality isn't interested. It just hits a wall. Next.
This question is from Vishalaksha Prabhu, and he asks, this is a question from Krishna Chanda, his 7-year-old son, and he asks, I am a small boy, and how can I start to serve Lord Krishna?
How can I start?
Yeah.
Well, according to your capacity, you start. You know, some hearing, some chanting, some worshipping, take prasadam. And your father can help you in, you know, customizing something that matches your nature in each of those categories. Take something that you do and you like to do and come before Krishna and offer that to Krishna, with the mood that Krishna should be pleased. Thinking of the example that you gave yesterday about offering it to Krishna. Ooh. Okay. Next.
The next question is from Claire Reed Mataji. And, there's one before that. The next question, so this question is from Pooja Shobha Chopra Mataji, and she asks, what is unconditional love, and how do you identify what is truly unconditional love? And have you ever met someone who is truly unconditional in this time?
Sure. Well, what is it? In really simple language, ahaitukiya pratyataya yatma supersedati. That's the Bhagavatam's definition of unconditional. Conditional is there's something at the starting end, there's something at the finishing end. So there's nothing at the starting end that can start it, and there's nothing that can interrupt it or stop it. That's unconditional love. That's unconditional love. It's spontaneous. Not depending upon. So how do you determine and identify? Well, make an obstacle and see what happens. Or, provide some reward for some nice devotional service and see what happens. Does someone have a tendency to become an enjoyer of the success of some nicely performed devotional service? So those are some litmus tests. And the third question, sure. Next.
From Claire Reed Mataji, she asks, since Kamsa could surrender to Parashuram, who is also the Lord himself, why did he fail to surrender to Krishna?
Because from Parashuram, he wanted something. And once he got that something, he felt himself invincible, so he doesn't need anything from Krishna. And in fact, it was foretold that Krishna would be the one who would kill him, so he doesn't surrender to the one who's... I mean, if he surrendered to Krishna, even it was prophesied to kill him, Krishna would change the destiny. But, you know, he's not of that disposition. He's, you know, he's a demon. Not interested in changing his destiny.
Akrura's response, this question's from Pooja Singh Mataji.
Okay.
And she asks, Akrura's response to Kamsa was encouraging, but still true to Shastra. When we are faced with people that say things that are blatantly opposite of what we have heard from Shastra, and we may not be in a position to correct that understanding, what principle should we keep in mind in responding to them while not being duplicitous?
Not being duplicitous? Well, you know, if you're Prahlad, you just say it. And if, you know, for the rest of us that aren't Prahlad, we may offer our little, you know, silent message to Super Soul. This is beyond my capacity to, or not my position to, speak anything in correction of a misdirected activity or speech. But I am your servant, you know, not necessarily elaborate, but we don't depart from the position of being Krishna's servant. And according to our capacity and the intelligence Krishna gives us, we conduct ourselves and speak accordingly. It may be we remain silent. It may be we speak something later. It may be so many maybes.
This next question is from Sanchari Mataji. Can pure devotees expand themselves like how Krishna expanded into multiple forms? My doubt comes when thinking of how pure devotees are sometimes called down to the material world. They are already liberated. So is their descent like when Krishna's associates descend for his pastimes in the sense that they are also eternally situated in the spiritual world?
A short answer is yes. She can take a look at an explanation given by Narada Muni to Gopa Kumar in the Vaikuntha section of Brihat Bhagavatamrita, where he says it, he elaborates. And Sanchari, send me a little reminder and I'll send you that section from Brihat Bhagavatamrita. It's a attached file that says what I just said.
The next question is from Uttama Bhakta Prabhu, and he asks, although distress and happiness are in the mind, they are still qualitatively different, with a question mark. And then he says, in my observation, even a mature devotee feels pleasant in a comfortable environment, even though he continues his service in both environments. That's a different question. Yeah.
It's qualitatively different on the subtle platform. On the absolute platform, it's illusion this way or that way. Happiness, distress. The configuration of the mind is illusion. Illusion has its diversity. We're done?
We have a couple more questions.
Okay.
This next one's also from Uttama Bhakta Prabhu. And he asks, off the topic, just curious, how does our pure love for Krishna in the spiritual world transform into lust in the material world? And he says, male, female, in parentheses, after lust.
Well, there's a presumption in the frame of his question. And the presumption, there's two. One is consciousness becomes transformed rather than consciousness becomes covered. So the frame of the question is a little misleading. And there's another second misleading, and that's something we discussed the other day about considering the living entity becoming covered as if it's an event in time when it's not. So you can forward to him those two references from Bhaktivinoda Thakur's writings. I sent them to you. Yes?
The one we're choosing for him.
Huh?
The one we're choosing for.
Yeah, but you can share them with Uttam Bhakta, and so he can understand what I'm saying from Bhaktivinoda Thakur's writing. Okay. And last.
Yeah. This one is from Amara Mataji.
Okay.
And she says, follow up. Since such demonic persons cannot recognize the mercy, what will ultimately change that mentality?
Krishna killed him. He got mercy anyways. Is that it?
Yes.
Srila Prabhupada ki jai.